Hey Earthlings, welcome back to Spaceship One, where we talk solutions that can repair and fuel Earth, our original spaceship. I'm your co-captain, Anna, and today we're talking about solid-state fusion, a type of advanced nuclear energy that is pretty next level. It does not require radioactive materials, and the metallic materials that it does require are found plentifully in nature. When these metals are exposed to hydrogen isotopes at high temperature, it creates a nuclear reaction that gives off excess heat. And this new way of producing energy would be super scalable, from a city to a car to a smartphone. Solid-state fusion has the potential to replace all fossil fuels and be the ultimate, abundant, clean energy source that is safe, reliable, and affordable. That's why I'm excited to have two people from the field on the podcast today. Iman Elsheikh and Jonah Messenger are both PhD students doing incredible work to push solid-state fusion forward. We'll be discussing everything from the physics to the history to the current challenges and opportunities. So, let's get into it. Welcome to Spaceship One, Jonah and Iman. Feel free to introduce yourself and your work.
Yeah, so my name is Jonah Messenger. I'm a PhD student in physics at the University of Cambridge. My sort of introduction to the solid state fusion field, more colloquially known as cold fusion, started in about February of 2022. So I'm actually quite new to the field. The field itself is sort of considered to be rather heretical in the physics community. And before February 2022, that was sort of my impression of the field. And yeah, I was working at an environmental think tank called the Breakthrough Institute, so eco-modernist think tank. So we sort of believe in technological solutions to environmental problems. And someone on the board co-authored an article in Nature reopening the cold case on cold fusion. And so when I saw that Nature article, I started to look into the field, and that started, a year and a half long process that's taken me to today and will take me into the future. So I'm very, very excited about this field and excited to be talking about it.
So excited to have you with us. And also you, Iman, I know you're a science historian, so maybe you could give us a little bit of background, not only on yourself, but also to what Jonah mentioned about the view of the physics community about cold fusion not being so favorable because of the history. I know the Pons and Fleischmann experiment might not be familiar for those of us born in the 90s or later, but because I think it happened in the 80s, is that right?
Yeah, 89. So my name is Iman. I'm a PhD student at the University of Chicago, actually a PhD candidate. And I'm writing my dissertation about the history and anthropology of fusion, more specifically cold fusion. And I also have worked as a public historian, writing for high school audiences and, non-scientists trying to translate some of this. And across both my work in both spaces, I found it really fascinating to think about this as a case study of what it would mean to evaluate whether a science is real or not. Like, is there a there? And in 1989, when Fleischmann and Pons, who it must be said were, very credentialed and celebrated scientists in their own right, electrochemists at the University of Utah, when they announced their findings, it was the biggest news ever. I mean, some of my professors remember getting these like faxes all the time about news, like what people were trying to figure out in terms of how to repeat their experiment. And so there was this, so-called replication crisis. People were excited, but they were also really rushing to reproduce these experiments. And there were some places that reported that they had reproduced them. There are many places that reported that they hadn't. And for many reasons, which are part of the subject of my dissertation, some of those things stuck a little better than others. And within a year, reputations were destroyed. People had really taken a position on where they stood on this, and it became increasingly difficult to call yourself a cold fusion proponent because it became synonymous with being a pseudoscientist. And there's a really interesting story there about, you know, what it means to reproduce an experiment, you know, what kind of knowledge you need, who was reproducing it and why it matters, how the government funding agencies and government agencies involved affected what kind of a hearing some of these researchers got. There's a lot to talk about there, but what's emerged is a science that everyone pronounced dead, but still lingers on. And I think that's what kind of caught my attention is that there's still a lot of people working on this. And now there's new people entering the field and looking at it differently. And I think it's a story that needs to be told and something that we need to keep thinking about as we are in a climate crisis and need to start getting a lot more creative about what kinds of ideas we look into in terms of clean energy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the potential blue sky vision would be small scale, solid state nuclear energy devices. You buy a cell phone, never need to charge it, computer, TV, etc. You would have the potential to completely decouple nuclear energy from radioactivity to sort of fundamentally change the energy landscape. So that's I think sort of the promise. But yeah, at this point, we are very much in the basic science realm. It hasn't been proven beyond a reasonable doubt to the wider scientific community. For me, what convinced me that there was, as Iman put it, some there, what really did it for me was really a variety of experiments by different research groups over the decades of unambiguous nuclear products. So things like neutron emission, neutrons flying out from samples, or high energy charged particles. These are things that you really can't, it's really hard to find explanations that don't require some sort of a novel nuclear process. And I think that there's another misconception about sort of the emergence of physical phenomena. You know, if someone says they saw something, then you could just do the same thing that they did and you should see the same result. And if you don't, then it's not real. That's sort of a very idealized linear framework for scientific discovery. I'm writing an article right now with a colleague of mine on sort of the emergence of different phenomena like the transistor or like nuclear fission, actually. I think it's sort of interesting. Most physicists don't know that the idea of breaking apart a nucleus would have been considered heretical in the 1920s, even for most of the 1930s. And so I think there's lots of lessons to be learned from a historical perspective about the emergence of different scientific phenomena that I think is quite relevant here.
Absolutely. So I kind of want to back up a bit. Nuclear falls under two categories. There's nuclear fission, which is the one that we're all familiar with. That's what we think of as nuclear today. And that's the breaking apart of atoms to create energy. And then there's nuclear fusion, which is fusing those atoms together. And with fusion, there's also two different types, mainly, right? There's the cold and there's the hot. And there's only the cold because there's the hot. With hot fusion, you're trying to like recreate a miniature sun. That's why it's hot fusion. It's millions of degrees. So we're trying to figure out a way to do that at a much lower temperature with cold fusion, trying to bring these hydrogen atoms that don't want to fuse, bring them together so that we can create energy. Feel free to correct any of that. That's my understanding.
No, that's a really good backdrop. So I guess the way to think about this is that if you take two hydrogen nuclei, so the centers of hydrogen atoms, get them really, really close to each other, you know, and they don't want to come close to each other because they're positively charged. And just like if you were to try to stick two positive ends of a magnet, they would repel each other, and you'd really have to push really, really hard to get them close to each other. So the same thing is true here. It's these hydrogen nuclei, they're pushing away. They don't want to come close to each other. But if you get them close enough to each other, there's another force. So that's the electromagnetic force that's keeping them apart. But there's another force, a nuclear force, a strong nuclear force in particular, that if you get them close enough together, they'll bind together. They'll fuse. It'll overcome that repulsion that you would feel like if you were sticking the two magnets together. So if you fuse two hydrogens together, the resulting nucleus that comes from the fused nuclei, it weighs ever so slightly less than the sum of the masses of the two nuclei that reacted together. And that missing mass gets converted into pure energy. So that's sort of the origin story for nuclear energy, and in this case, fusion energy. as you mentioned, right, we know that there's a giant fusion reactor, for example, in our solar system, the sun. And the name of the game is basically dump as much kinetic energy, as much heat energy as you can, so that these nuclei are moving around really fast and they have enough energy to push back against the repulsion. And so the concept of cold fusion is sort of, you know, from that frame of reference, it doesn't really make sense, right? It shouldn't be possible that you could fuse nuclei at these low temperatures. And so I think my reaction, if you had asked me 2 years ago, to cold fusion, it would have been just that, well, it can't be possible, it doesn't make sense. But it turns out, actually, that there's a variety of sort of quantum physical phenomena, collective effects. In the conventional fusion picture, when you're getting all of these atoms really, really hot, eventually they get so hot that you actually go to a state of matter beyond a gas. So if you heat up a gas enough, you get something that's called a plasma. And a plasma is where the electrons are ripped off of the atoms. And so you've got this sort of negatively charged electron and the positively charged nucleus. So it's sort of like a charged gas, if you will. And the fundamental assumption that you would make when you're doing these sort of fusion calculations is that the chances that those two nuclei come close enough together to fuse is completely independent. It has nothing to do with any other pairs of hydrogen that might be interacting with one another. But in a solid metal framework, that assumption doesn't quite hold. These cold fusion experiments take place in something called the metal hydride, which is basically metal that absorbs hydrogen really well. And the hydrogen can literally go inside the metal structure. And if you apply certain conditions to these metals, the assumption that the pairs of hydrogen that are interacting are independent from one another starts to break down. And so my area of interest particularly is on studying these conditions and trying to understand how some of these interactions between different pairs of hydrogen can start to unleash possibilities that on the face of it would seem at least highly, highly improbable, if not impossible.
Yeah, that sounds like a super exciting thing to work on. What would you say are the top barriers to progress in this field? And how can we work to overcome those barriers?
You know, very broadly speaking, like political priorities in terms of scientific funding and what kind of science gets funded. We don't have a lot of money for basic research, much less for basic research that's been maligned for decades. And then that kind of links up to another barrier, which is sort of an inherent conservative attitude in at least funding agencies about what kinds of things are worth funding. And then I think another barrier might be internal to the community, right? Like inability to clarify a vocabulary that's shared, a set of experiments that's shared. You know, there's just so much diversity that it's hard to get clear claims coming out that everyone can sort of evaluate, because there's just so much clamor and so much contest, even if it's in good faith. It ends up not translating well to people outside the community who are already not primed to take it seriously. So I think all three of those probably contribute to some difficulty. And I think the solid state fusion project that Jonah and I are both working on is working towards alleviating some of those, both in terms of trying to talk about this field in a way that is more cohesive and translates things a little better to mainstream, you know, lay people, scientists, investors, try to educate people about what the field is and what they're doing, but also try to lay out the merits of continuing this basic research, even if it doesn't seem like a high political priority.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the Department of Energy has, for the first time in 30 years, started to fund cold fusion through their sort of innovation arm, ARPA-E, Advanced Research Project Agency for Energy. So we have sort of a research program now that's not got a lot of money, like Niman mentioned, but it's enough to really sort of do good science. And I'm working on one of those teams. And it's a big deal that the Department of Energy is funding this. And kudos to the leadership there, because they really looked at the literature and said that there's enough here that seems anomalous that we should be studying this. And so kudos to them. But I definitely agree that there is a sort of deep conservative milieu in the science field broadly. I think that culture of scientific austerity has sort of creeped into scientific investigation itself. The general scientific community has become quite uncomfortable with scientific ambiguity. I really don't think that many people understand the degree to which nuclear fission, you know, when it was first proposed by Ida Nodak, it was chastised for about 6 years, I think, until it became clear that actually she was spot on, that the nucleus was breaking up. Ironically, Enrico Fermi won the Nobel Prize for his neutron bombardment of uranium. They weren't calling it nuclear fission then, but that's what he was doing. He won the Nobel Prize with the wrong concept of what was happening. He thought that the nuclei were actually getting bigger, not breaking up into smaller pieces. But it's just sort of interesting, right, that there was such ambiguity. They were just straight up wrong for 6 years, which doesn't mean that every sort of, you know, out of left field idea is correct. The point is that there is sort of a framework for scientific discovery that I think conventional institutions of science today have become unable to navigate. You know, then when you look at the cold fusion community, one of the surprises for me was the number of people who work on this field who make real progress, actually, that are, I mean, quite literally retired. This is essentially their hobby. I've been to people's homes who have, you know, essentially cold fusion reactors, right, on their third floor of their home or something like that. And these people put out work that I think is actually super interesting, that have potentially real live nuclear anomalies that conventional nuclear theory can't explain. And that will never get published in a mainstream research journal, right? And I should be clear, a lot of the nuclear anomalies that I point to in the literature are not from hobbyists. They are from mainstream research universities or government labs. But I think the point remains, you have different communities that are doing science, but there is no way that those communities can talk to each other. One of the things that I'm really interested in is sitting at the intersection of those two communities and trying to sort of say, you know, okay, I know what it looks like to do an experiment, characterize it thoroughly. I know what it looks like to get that into a paper, but I'm also comfortable going into a hobbyist lab, understanding the experiments they're doing, and trying to bring some sort of more rigor and top-notch tools that physical science has to offer to those experiments to sort of really probe further and decide, you know, is this actually an anomalous result? Is this actually something that is as of yet unexplained, or is there some sort of error? But I think it doesn't help that the scientific community has gotten more conservative, less ambitious. It's one of these things where from within the community, you can't see that there's been that deterioration. But to me, it's quite clear. And I think sort of looking at it from this lens of working on cold fusion, where there has been decades of work in this field, good work, trying to do experiments and share data within the community. We have a, you know, international conference on condensed matter nuclear science. So we have our own conference. The field has their own journal. Most journals will not accept and might not even review cold fusion papers. And that goes for Nobel Prize winning physicists. I mean, Julian Schwanger, who won the Nobel Prize, I would bet a lot of my small stipend that very few people in the physics community know that Julian Schwanger was working on cold fusion in his last years of life. I think they'd be quite surprised at that. But even he couldn't get published in the American Physical Society's conference proceedings and journals. There is sort of a real palpable stigma. Iman's braver than I am to do her dissertation on fusion. But I think that there is a recipe to take experiments that have shown some sort of reasonable amount of reproducibility in the past that show results that would be, you know, if true, impossible to assign to a non-nuclear process. And that if you can bring the top-notch tools to science that one might have access to at a, you know, national lab or at a top research university, that you can make a publication that might not explain cold fusion, but it can prove that there is an anomalous, inherently nuclear result. And I think if you publish such a result, the mainstream scientific community will move quite quickly. You know, there'll still be plenty of skepticism, but you will have a large influx of labs that you never thought would be working on cold fusion start to work on this subject. And I think that's ultimately what we need. I think it's an incredibly difficult process to understand and to probe, and there's so many different parameters at play. And I think you just need thousands of labs across the world working on it to really sort of crack the code.
I think that the ambiguity is something that should be a starting point. And unfortunately, a lot of people in the scientific community take that as a sign that it's not worth pursuing. You know, as kids, we were taught about scientific curiosity in a certain way. And the more I've studied modern science since the Cold War, it hasn't felt like that ever sets a priority. One of the reasons it's inspiring to talk to a lot of scientists in this field is that they retain this curiosity and this commitment to just like finding out the thing. And of course, many of them do have an eye on applications, but I think it's a very, very long timeline. And I think many of them know that. And despite knowing that the potential applications of this may exceed their own lifetimes, they still have poured hours and hours of thankless labor into it. I think we owe a lot to them. And I really hope that people are able to tolerate ambiguity and connect with that curiosity enough to continue to work on this really interesting field.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because science is about being curious, you know, at its most fundamental level. Science is about being open to new information and pursuing that and just, yeah, figuring it out. So do you feel like there could be more room for science communicators in this field particularly that speak to the value of investing more resources into it? You know, like Jonah said, having labs all over the world, thousands of labs all over the world work on this. You know, it's not just a really cool scientific endeavor, it's also potentially game-changing for humanity.
I think that's really important. I think we need to get more creative about what kind of scientific communications we have. You know, on our team at the Anthropocene Institute, we're trying all kinds of different techniques to communicate with people and with all different stakes in the field. We had this really great discussion about, well, what would it take to come up with this, like, almost portable experiment? You know, in this field, we've had all this talk about we need the reproducible experiment, the reference experiment, this idea that we just need the thing that will prove something, whether we prove that something is happening, that there's an anomaly, that it's nuclear. You know, there are various stages of proof that are being asked for here. But if we look at, for example, you know, the famous experimentalist Faraday, that's a technique that he used. He tried to create a portable experiment. He tried to give a description that was sufficient for people to be able to witness the phenomenon. And in a lot of ways, he was not just an experimenter, but a scientific communicator himself, because the way he set up his laboratory, he essentially would perform the experiment. I mean, people used to come into these labs as though they were theaters and witness this. And of course, what he presented then was a much more polished and cleaned up and persuasive experiment. We like to think of experiments as things that just show themselves, but you know, experiments have to be persuasive. They have to have a rhetoric that shows that something is happening. A good experiment has the right parameters to do that. So as Jonah said, you know, for many people, heat is just simply not persuasive enough. A nuclear product is. That doesn't mean that the experiments that have excess heat are not good experiments. It's just that for their particular audience, for example, mainstream physicists, they're not persuasive. So, you know, I'm always kind of inspired when I'm thinking about how to communicate with scientists, to think about how other scientists in the past have managed to make their experiments exciting. And what does it mean for an experiment to look rigorous? I mean, we know that many, many fields, when they first started, were not taken seriously. Even something as big as quantum theory now, when it started, people weren't very interested in taking it seriously. You know, studying those transformations, I think, is a really, really great reservoir of information and insight for science studies now. If scientists are looking to apply it, they can take lessons from this. And what's fascinating about this community is that they're doing this. I mean, I, you know, have seldom seen groups of scientists so readily try to understand the history and sociology of science so that they can advance their own field. I think that scientific communications could do a lot for the field, but I do think we need to think outside the box and be really creative with what we use as inspirations.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem here is that most scientists know next to nothing about the history of their fields, and they think they do, but they don't. I mean, so like Wolfgang Pauli, who was sort of a famous physicist, laid some of the groundworks for quantum theory. He has this hilarious quote from, I think it was in the 20s, and he said, quote, "One shouldn't work on semiconductors. That is a filthy mess. Who knows whether any semiconductors exist?" Another person who had experimental evidence for significant phenomena that allowed transistors to really explode, there was a really great interview that he did with, I think it was the American Institute of Physics. No one thought that the transistor would become a huge thing, or it was not clear at all. It wasn't clear that this, you know, sort of discovery I made in my PhD would be so significant. I was just getting a PhD, you know. So this is sort of the rule, not the exception. In the moment, you don't know you're in the moment. And in the moment, it's inherently ambiguous and uncertain. And then sort of in hindsight, it all makes sense. And I think that, like, in hindsight, the general scientific community will look at this period of the last, 20 years or 30 years and sort of say like, oh yeah, of course, like it all makes sense in hindsight. But the other thing I was going to mention about sort of science communication is I think oftentimes people think that science communication is a one-way street from science to the public. But I think maybe even more important is, as Iman was highlighting, communication within and across scientific fields and domains. The fusion science field has been inextricably, fundamentally tied to plasma science and plasma physics for decades. But a lot of these phenomena that I think are sort of fundamental to providing a theoretical scaffold that starts to explain how cold fusion could be possible. From a plasma physicist's perspective, those sort of principles have absolutely nothing to do with plasma physics, nothing at all. And they're much more applicable in the study of like light matter interaction. And that's actually the sub department that I'm at Cambridge. But the people who I work with would never make the connection that the principles that they work on that are totally well-established, uncontroversial, and sort of banal could have really radical implications at the nuclear energy scale. And so there is this sort of disconnect, inability to transfer concepts and ideas across artificial boundaries that have been set up. And it's not impossible to do this. I was at a conference a few months ago, presented a poster, didn't mention cold fusion once, but I had a bunch of colleagues totally understand how I was making these connections of, connecting, again, principles that take place at the low energy scale, like in this light matter interaction field, right? And saying that these concepts could readily be applied and actually are applied at the nuclear scale already today, that that field already exists of sort of quantum nuclear science. Sort of the full implications of these dynamics are not fully appreciated, I think. And I think part of that is a communications issue, a sort of artificial knowledge gap or knowledge barrier, really, that prevents providing the context for the fusion community to understand why something like cold fusion or low energy nuclear reactions rely on these collective effects that I was drawing earlier. So not thinking about all these hydrogen pairs sort of interacting with each other independently, but actually thinking about them as one collective system that is working together. They're not independent from one another. That's a totally foreign concept to the general way that people think about fusion science in a plasma physics context.
So it sounds like we need a lot more communication and collaboration between different fields in science in order to advance solid state fusion. And in general, just a lot more people working on it. From what I can gather, as a non-scientist, this field is very complex, challenging, and even frustrating at times. So I have to ask, what keeps you going? What motivates you to do this work day in and day out?
Well, I'm naive, so I think that this is all going to get settled quickly, but that's because I'm naive. What keeps me sort of working in this field is the first is that I think that the potential implications are totally radical. And then the other thing is that my scientific interest is really working on things that have what I perceive to be a misplaced stigma or taboo, a field that needs to be broken open and where there's really sort of opportunity to make real scientific impact. It's just a more interesting, exciting, dynamic space that I've come to quite like. So between that and sort of the societal implications, it's something that I'm quite committed to working on for the foreseeable future, even if my naive hopes for the field don't pan out.
I share a lot of what Jonah said. I have a whole lot of sort of tangled reasons. Like one is like my own curiosity, like why was this so suppressed for so long? Why now? What's changing? What's happening in our particular moment of climate crisis that moonshot science is on the table again? And this is what it's been classified as, right? Like this is a moonshot, People are talking about getting to Mars and there's all this interest in things that previously were in the domain of pathological or pseudo or fringe or science fiction. And all of a sudden now people are looking at them a little bit differently. And so I'm really interested in that process. Also, rooting for the underdog in many ways. I've befriended many of these scientists. And want to really interrogate what's at the heart of a lot of these taboos and these places we don't go in science. It really makes me want to, you know, as a scholar, think more deeply about what is this thing we called science and what its authority is when we need its authority very badly in a time of climate crisis. We need its authority in times of pandemics, but we also aren't thinking very critically about how that authority is built and maintained and what it's made of. And, you know, above all, like there's a question that a friend of mine asked me that stays stuck and lodged in my head as I do my work. And I basically moved to a new neighborhood during the pandemic. I didn't really have many social contacts, as many of us didn't. But I used to go on walks in the park, and a friendly neighbor of mine, who's now someone I consider a friend, who was a retired chemist, started chatting with me about all kinds of scientific mysteries surrounding water and solid materials that he was really interested in. And over our many conversations, I found myself increasingly not questioning him for things that I'm told are not serious, but questioning my own skepticism that we're told we're supposed to have, and asking myself, by what authority am I supposed to dismiss him? And he asked a question that motivates my research to this day, which was, where's the error in my claim? You know, and thinking about that and thinking about how we can go about answering that question, and why we often are met with a refusal to answer that question. People aren't willing to evaluate a specific claim, but rather, you know, want to dismiss things out of hand because of the kind of person who works on them, because they've worked on cold fusion before, therefore we can't take them seriously. But also, like, what are the stakes in not answering that question in the context of climate insecurity? And why can't we try to answer that question? That really got me started, and that research has gathered momentum, and I'm still doing it now. And I'd really love to do like an oral history of this field, because if nothing else, so much committed work has been done that I think is worth remembering and honoring.
Absolutely. I just want to thank you, Iman and Jonah, for your work on solid state fusion and for joining me on Spaceship One.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much. Really happy to be here.
Hey, Earthlings. Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's episode, share it with a friend who might find it interesting. We also want to give a special shout out to our sponsor, the Anthropocene Institute, and their solid state fusion projects, which Jonah and Iman both contribute to. Check it out at solidstatefusion.org. Catch you next time, Earthlings.